Okay, we're up and running. It's Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, and we're working our way through The Joy of Sacrifice by E.J. Gold. It's an unusual book, and I strongly recommend everybody get a copy of it and work your way through it. The real challenge is to work your way through a book like this with others. Here's what happens. If you read a book like this, you'll read it and you go, oh, yeah, I understand that. And on you go to the next chapter. But in a certain way, when we're working on it together here, we're forced to look at it for a week, and at least that. And some of them will stick with you or haunt you even longer than that. And for instance, the sacrifice we're on tonight is Sacrifice 11. Sacrifice 11 is, it's more than halfway through, Ivan. But, it's page 217, and it's called The Sacrifice of the Guru. And then the subtitle is Life of Hopelessness. But I think fortunately for us, it's only two paragraphs. No, better yet, it's only one paragraph long. So it should make fast. We should understand it quite well and be quite simple, I think. Right, Ivan?
Sure thing, yeah.
Yeah, Ivan's up for it. Just a snap. Because it's so short, I thought that I'm going to read the entire chapter.
I think David was insinuating this is like Zen koans. When you get down to the one-liner, then it's really straightforward and simple, right?
Apparently. What's that? Okay. So, this is The Joy of Sacrifice, The Joy of Sacrifice by E.J. Gold. This is Sacrifice 11, Sacrifice of the Guru. In order to achieve this sacrifice, here's the instruction that we get. One lives as the guru and receives homage and respect as the embodiment of the great guide. One must neither inwardly nor outwardly break the role during this stage. One gathers disciples cheerfully and dispenses grace according to objective merit and objective impartial justice. One becomes the guru, thus sacrificing the outer health of another. I'm just wondering, is there anybody that has actually tried this week? Did you even attempt to put yourself in that position and consider standing in those shoes for a few days? Go ahead.
Yeah, I have done it. Not this week, but I have done it before. I have done it before too. I have been in periods where I didn't have any guide at all, and actually I don't have a guru per se.
Yeah.
And there may have been a group of people, or maybe a couple, or one, in which I had to, you know, just trusting whatever I knew, and maybe give them some guidance.
I know that Tiff has done this kind of work. So let's parse it a little bit, Ivan. Okay. Actually, why don't we start with? There's one post on the website. Website is Wings of Chaos. .com, and there was one, as I left this afternoon, there was one comment by Aria, which I want to thank her for. And Ivan, do you want to read it to us?
I can read it.
Yeah.
Comment. I keep trying to think of what to say about this chapter. I have had some interesting glimpses of what a teacher goes through and how much is demanded of them, how vulnerable they become, how exposed, how difficult it is, and the immense responsibility to guide a student, how much they give of themselves. All I can say to the thought of taking this position is, oh, hell no. Even I'm not that crazy. Even I'm not that crazy. But I greatly and sincerely appreciate the sacrifice of those who are and do. They are very special and rare people. Much love and thanks. That's very gracious.
And
I feel about the same way. Hell no, I'm not ready for this one.
Well, but that's not the point,
yeah.
Is it? The point is, are you ready for it? I guarantee you that when you're in that position, it's not a matter of being ready for it. There's not a committee that you go to where you don't apply for the job. You're sucked into it in a certain way, and I can't imagine that it's something that one would want to do, but it is something that people wind up doing. So what happens when you put yourself in that position? That's my question. This is not a sacrifice that for all gurus everywhere. This is a sacrifice for voyagers on the path. And the sacrifice says one lives with the guru and receives homage and respect as the embodiment of the great guide. So what the heck does that mean? What is the great guide? What would it be like embodiment of the great guide? What does that mean to us? So here you're standing there in the position, and it's not a bad exercise. It's easy to dismiss this chapter and to say, oh, I'm not a guru, so therefore this doesn't apply to me. It does apply to you. It applies to each of us. And so what does it mean to stand in the position as if you were receiving respect and homage as the embodiment of the great guide? Just speculate. That's the challenge here. Go ahead and let the green light start to work. Don't worry about it or what you think others might think of you. What would it be like to stand in his shoes as the great guide?
I may say, Guillermo here speaking, when I have been in that situation, what EJ calls the great guide, I call it the great current.
Okay.
The great current. And it is based how I, if I got to say something or play that role in that moment, first of all, it begins with my intent. When I put my intent into the great guide, whoever that is, or the great current, and I trust that my words are going to be aligned for what the great current wants me to say.
Okay.
So it's somehow a leap of faith within my responsibility.
Okay,
that
so
what I am saying is not going to be for the detriment of the people listening to me.
Let's get more specific mechanically inside. What inner posture would you be in if you were standing in that position? Go ahead, Molly. So one comment from Piff is, it means one must produce one's own shocks. Did I get it right? So one must produce one's own shocks. So let's just rewind a little bit. That's a critical point that's being brought up there. So I want to rewind. What position would you be in such that you could stand in the shoes called that's being
the great guide?
The great guide. Standing in the shoes of the great guide. Does that mean that you rise up as this great ego and to stand there? This great in person, I am the great guide? Is that what it says?
That's right.
No, I think that you're like a channel of the great guide.
Then how do you become a channel? What are some of the attributes?
Well, first of all, you have to have your machine awaken.
There's no question that you have to be in the waking state. But if you are just a simple point of view, if you're going to be a channel, isn't there an element of surrender involved?
Absolutely. There is surrender, and there is a very tested, whatever I'm going to say will have to be already tested by my experience.
I'm not sure about that. Tested by your experience?
Yeah, I don't know about that part of it.
I mean, suppose you're the source. You're the embodiment of this great guide, so you're now the source for other people. You have no outside help. It's because it's you alone are the source. You're responsible for that.
Instead of the word surrender comes to mind, but the word surrender doesn't always hit it for me. I use the word acquiescence. Acquiescence for me embodies more the concept of an active surrender. But what it is you're surrendering is the life of the machine. And isn't that not what we're talking about throughout the last 10 sacrifices? We're moving away from the dominance of the machine to living a life in another world called the essential self. Our ears may not be clear enough to hear yet, but the challenge, and this is why I say don't dismiss this chapter out of hand. Stand in the position as if you were in that moment of the great guide. Stand in the position called the embodiment of the great guide and receive homage. But it's not you that's receiving it. Is this not clear? It's not you, the brash ego that wants to come forth and say, finally, they've recognized me. Of course the ego wants to say that. That's its job. That's what it does for a living. This is a more dangerous position called the great guide, where you are able to stand aside with a great effort. And being there, of course, then you are just a channel to receive the homage and respect. Actually practice it. I'm just thinking of the labyrinth, walking the labyrinth. If you actually stand in the center of that labyrinth and allow the invocation that is there to come through, it will hit you. At that moment, there's a little teeny bit of called the embodiment of the great guide. We don't have the skill necessarily all the time to know how to deal with that. But we have the ability to practice standing in that fire. It is not a place of comfort. But go ahead. Anything else, Molly? Go ahead. Okay, hang on. So Pianjo is saying we have to remember the conference of the birds where the sparrow is the proudest. It takes courage to expose yourself so that everyone else sees it, right? And that's the heart of it, is what Arya is saying, is how to be objective, how to get out of the way. How do you even have the discernment to know what it means to get out of the way? So go from being an end user to being a conduit. And then at that point, each of us can be a source. And a small source, to whatever extent we can. This is a difficult sacrifice because it really, what it entails, it asks you to give up your ego enough to stand in this exercise and do this sacrifice. be there for a moment. Be there for a moment, not for your own good, but for the good of the work. I maintain that the reason that the secret keeps itself is that the divine is desperately trying to give away the secret, and no one here wants to take it. Because for me, the theme of the great of this joy of sacrifice and the sacrifices is us embracing the responsibility of taking on some of these magnificent enrobments that are out there.
And then, David?
Yes.
This is Mark in Winnipeg.
Hey, Mark. Greetings.
How you doing?
Good, good, good.
Reading back, when invoking a tutelary entity, and of course there's many tutelary entities, I think the invocational space, you become passive, the tutelary entity or the entity that, that channels or speaks through you or in enables the work with respect to the study group is invoked partially by the necessity of the study group and the questions. That's what I found through practical experience.
Yeah,
and in,
so,
in that state, I wasn't entirely in the waking state because following that process, I had to do some instruction and explanation, like probably 40, 50, 100 times over the years. But with respect to the information that E.G. has given with respect to his invocations, he remains active and he holds the tutelary entity. And it's a complete reversal. He doesn't go into a process of being inactive or passive. He remains very active. And
I think that's a really important element here that Mark is bringing out, that when you are standing in that position, even though you are in acquiescence, you have to be very active, because only in that active attention that you bring to the game, that's what you can bring. You can bring attention and presence. And if you bring that active attention with your intention, and then if you're able then to channel something for the sake of others. So active is a critical element here. So if all we can do is pretend that we're going to do this, pretend doing it then. Actually pretend doing it, that first sentence then, standing in the great guide. I mean, how do these classes work? They don't work because there's some like great linear knowledge. They work because together there's a form of invocation. There's an invocation that creates an embodiment, and through that embodiment, something can be invoked that then we can verbalize and put into the world. We can put into the world for the sake of others. And it's always fresh. It's always fresh to the extent that we are as active as Mark is indicating here. Okay? That's the first sentence in the chapter.
And David, that's exactly what you're doing with respect to being the study group leader here. You are pretending, and then all of a sudden, like I've seen watching you on the film, the tension builds, the necessity builds, there's questions, and you sort of roll with it. And then there's the invocation, and then you say something. It's like lighting the candles on the cake. The illumination, but it doesn't happen that often.
And it doesn't, it's not a linear process. It's not the accumulation of more linear knowledge. It's the practice of presence and knowing how to, it's kind of the wrong word, but it's how to behave in the space. Is there a better word?
Absolutely. It's space protocols, exactly. And that goes into the macro dimensions. I'm occupying time that other people in the study group might want to have comments, so I'll sit back. But your commentary immediately made me run to the phone because it's very interesting because I've been watching it in action with you and Ivan in the last couple of weeks.
So let's, just for the sake of the chapter, let's move on. These are huge points that Mark has made.
There was a comment we passed by. Molly was reading. Comment of Piff's.
Piff was talking about acquiescence. Living from somewhere else internally is what is intriguing. We can live in a different space. For me, the reason this book is so remarkable is that it is helping, it's pointing the way. It's giving us pointers, but we have to remember the pointers for me are internal, okay? The pointers are pointing to an internal space. And when we are in those internal spaces, that is where it starts to happen. So it's not a matter of learning more, speaking more. It's a learning of discernment and pragmatic discernment of how it works in you. And for me, I said this before. For some reason, I look from the center of my chest area. That's where most of my eyes are. That's where my vision comes from. Not doesn't come from my eyes. I seem to look from here. And when I look from this part of my chest, it seems like that's where I navigate from. I don't know what else to say.
Well, I was interested in this point about being active or not. If you are the embodiment of the great guide, if I'm being the embodiment of the great guide, am I there at all? Am I still there? Am I active?
Yes.
Or have I invoked on myself? Have I brought down upon myself this persona?
This is an important question that Ivan's asking.
Spirit or entity of the great guide.
The invocation of the entity.
Yeah.
Am I still there? My answer to that is yes. But it's so fundamentally different a yes. It's not the Ivan or the David that operates in the world. It's so fundamentally different. But we each have a signature of our essential self. And it's that signature. I don't know how to... that's just a good way. It's
the waking state, you mean?
When each of us are in the highest part of our own waking state, we each still have a temperament or a signature that is... we seek. I was talking with somebody earlier this week, and we were working on the question, who am I? Think about how to answer that. If you really sit there and you ask yourself, well, who am I? And what does it seem like? You know, what does it mean? And you really look inward, what you sense really is an electrical field. You do get to that point. But then, when you answer the who am I part, it's not, he's the one that does this, 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 and this. But you can see kind of a different signature that you might have. And I've seen many, many people in very important spaces, and they each bring a different handshake to it. Okay? But I want to go on to the next sentence. Well, the next one is, one must neither inwardly nor outwardly break the role during this stage. You'll want to break it because you'll want to go back to the safety harness of the machine. That's the whole theme of the last several sacrifices here. Now, but the next sentence, one gathers disciples cheerfully and dispenses grace according to objective merit and impartial justice. What the heck does that mean, Ivan?
Well, it means you better be the guru. You better do the right job if you're being the guru. You better do a good job.
Dispenses grace according to objective merit and impartial justice. Now, Piff, I don't want to put you on the spot here, but and I could be really wrong, but when I read that over the weekend, I remember one of the very early conventions. It was quite a big convention, and you and I actually, as odd as it sounds, we actually were dancing together. It was like everybody was dancing, and it was quite something, and it was very unusual, but we and you and I were dancing, and there was this click, and, you know, we knew that we had reached this particular space. During that cycle, I don't think it was necessarily that night, we talked about the idea of grace, or at least my memory says that, because when I read this, your name came up. So what does it mean to dispense grace according to objective merit and impartial justice? I won't go into the Bible. I didn't bring my Bible, thank God. I would have read from King James on the parable of the talents. In the parable of the talents, to him that has, it shall be given more. And he who has not, that which he has will be taken from him. Do you recall this? It's a longer parable than I want to go into at the moment, but it's worth reading. And it has a lot to do also with the quote we read last week about when you decide and put your intention forward, the universe moves. It moves and help comes to you. Okay, so that's what objective merit. It's not a, I like him or her, therefore I'll give them this. It's just simple merit. So what could it mean to the word or the phrase to dispense grace? Anna? The pith is saying it means to be in the balance, to keep one's intent clean.
Well, to be the great guide, I think that is, you need to follow that protocol to be the great guide.
Nothingness gets touched. Thank you. That's the point. That you are then, what's coming in is not of the world at all. And what we're starting to talk about here, and we're getting hints about, for us to practice, knowing that we are voyagers on the path. We are not gurus. That's why it's a practice we're given.
Mm-hmm.
But the practice has to do with emanation, and that's a word that Silverdale I'm using in a particular way, as you so well know, and the practice of emanating in an appropriate manner. Does this make sense? Okay, so when we're in these positions, and you're doing that kind of practice, you're obviously way outside your league at that point. You're over the top. That we understand. But the point of it is to see what it's like to stand in those shoes. Okay? Anything else, Molly? All quiet on the Western Front.
Well, I mean, very simply, what I associate with dispensing grace is that you're bopping people with flowers. You know, you tap them
in
with a flower, you give out candy. to, yeah, you know, the Halloween coming on, Molly said. But, yeah, it's the, there are gestures of grace. So there are ways, appropriate ways, the way the guru dispenses grace. I get out of the language of this that you are sort of acquiescing, as you say, you know,
yeah,
this role. You're just assuming the role. And, I mean, why would he say that you have to stay in character innerly and outerly? I mean, like saying, you know, if you were identified with being this guru, then you wouldn't have to be
game over.
Advised. Well, you wouldn't have to be reminded that you must neither inwardly nor outwardly break the role during this stage. So it's like suggesting that it's a theater, you know, it's a piece of theater.
But when we practice certain kinds of theater, and if we stand in those roles, sometimes we can get information that's important to us and to others as well.
Hey, Dave, maybe I can throw in a couple of cents.
Yes. Thank you, Silverdale.
Well, you know, if we go back to human biological machine, we're informed that our essential self is dominated by the by our historical personality, and our effort is to try and shift the center of our gravity from perception of the world around us from our historical personality to our essential self. And so the book The Joy of Sacrifice is kind of a roadmap for aspects of the historical personality that are shed in order to allow the essential self to grow, become predominant, and be our center of gravity. And so when we get to the joy when we get to the sacrifice of the guru, we begin to perceive that our essential self is now our center of gravity. It is emanating, that is, it is like the sun, which is serving as the guru to our to the multiplicity and diversity of our historical personality. So, you know, we're comprised of countless billions of individual historical identities or postures, and the essential self is trying to serve as our guru and dispenses objective merit and impartial justice as it continues to harness our historical personality. So rather than reading all this literally, how might we do this in our daily life, it's really a reflection of our essential self achieving the predominant position within our personal trinity.
So if you start to think in terms of what would it therefore mean to gather disciples? And
that's right. And for me, the way I would answer that is look at if I have five or six dominant behavior patterns or characteristics of who I know myself to be, each one of those represent disciples that I'm trying to bring under the influence of my essential self. And so when I read, for example, Meetings with Remarkable Men by Gurdjieff, each of those chapters we can read literally. These are people, individuals he met over the course of his life, but they might also represent aspects of his own historical personality to which he assigned a name and a characteristic and brought within his own monastery of the essential self.
So our work is inner, and our work is very personal. And we can stand in that position and see the disciples that suddenly there's a pastor in town, there's a new sheriff in town, there's a new guide in town.
Yeah.
And we're shifting guides from the safety of the mechanical self to a different guide. It's the temperature there is tough, but as it said, stay in character, right, Ivan?
Right.
Stay in character.
Yes.
Don't break character. Neither inwardly nor outwardly break the role during this stage. Very difficult to stand there.
I have a couple of comments here if you would like to read from.
Go ahead.
Right? Lost Horizon says, objective and impartial decisions do not come from personal feelings or thoughts.
Right.
Greater necessity is at work. Piangio follows, acting in this manner may be the same thing as being truly unattached to the fruits of your labor.
Let's dig there a little bit, what these individuals are saying, and let's dig and say, what therefore would be the form that dispensing grace would take? I'll give an example.
Right.
I've brought this example up before, and it's kind of it's mundane, but it's safe, probably safe for me to express too. And I was observing myself one time, and I noticed, this is when I would go to work, and I'd wear a tie almost every day. And so I'm putting my tie on, and I'm tying a single Windsor knot. And as I'm doing it, suddenly I noticed my hands, in a sense, working independently of me. I just noticed them, in a sense, tying the tie. And I was so amazed to watch this event occur. And then something happened. Then I was just kind of showered with a thankfulness for my hands doing that. I was thankful that the machine had learned to do that on my behalf. And it hit me so powerfully that I was able to take it to other areas. Even when the ego comes up, arrogance comes up, in a certain way, you can say, be thankful with regard to that, because it was trying to protect you when it was trying to protect you. But now its life is over, isn't it? We no longer need that kind of protection in most of our activities, because there's a new place to stand now, isn't there? Ivan, I'm going to have to bring my Bible next week and read that Corinthians 13.
Which is, and we can pass the hat at the end of the session.
No, it's just if anybody has the Bible really quickly, I believe it's Corinthians 13 and then the end of that. It would be nice to hear that read.
All right, somebody can pull it off the shelf. You know, I wonder if I'd like to know if anyone has comment on why the subtitle here is...
We're not there yet.
You don't want to go to that yet?
Yeah, no, that's really important. I'm watching the clock because that's like
all right.
Really important. But at the last sentence, we'll go to that. Okay, the last sentence in the paragraph is, one becomes the guru, thus sacrificing the outer help of another. So we've done this kind of work. We've begun to establish ourselves as this inner guru. And then, thus sacrificing the outer help of another.
Well, we need to be tuned in
to
the help channel.
No, we get tuned into our help channel.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
To our specific flavor, what that might be. There's a specific flavor that we all have. I mean, I look at someone, you know, like there's a lot of people that are here that have been worked very, very hard. Silverdale, Simon, Piff, Lost Horizon, Piangio, Aria, Pathwell, I don't know who else is on, but have put in a lot of hours in this trade. And each one has their own signature to how they approach this. And it's having a sense of what that feels like. What is it that you love? What are you compelled, in a sense, to do? Why are you here? What is it that we're doing? So what is your own guru-ness, in a sense, in this context, mean? How does it look to you? And maybe all you can't necessarily describe it in a linear manner, but you might be able to describe it electrically and sense what it feels like. So I think it's important that last sentence is important to realize that we have a lot of work to do in this chapter of standing in that particular place.
And you know, David, in my experience, as it was explained, you know, our physical body and our essential self really have no interest at all in voluntary evolution, but our historical personality does, because it kind of begins to grasp the importance of this pursuit. So in the beginning, our historical personality is trying to organize our affairs in order to facilitate the growth and development and maturity of our essential self, to the point where the essential self does become our center of gravity, and it then has to accept that it can no longer rely upon the historical personality to make that effort. It must make that effort itself as the guru, which is the embodiment of the great guide, that is the particle of divinity which is represented by our essential self.
Right. So in a sense, what's happened, because we're on the path, the ground has been set. The play has been set out. Now comes forth the inner guru, the inner essential self. It's time to start your part of the bargain.
The master's returned to his house.
The master's returned to his house. That's why we've created the ground that's now possible. Okay, time to take that on now. And this is not a passive surrender from, it's an active activation that occurs, and we begin to discover this. Okay?
By the way, David, I do have Corinthians 13 here. That's the chapter on love, right? Do you want to hear any of it or just be reminded?
The one about I see through a glass darkly. I think it's toward the end of that.
For chapter verse 12, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, just as I also have been fully known. But now abide faith, hope, love, these three, but the greatest of these is love.
Gratitude and love, yeah. This is not the King James Version, but it embodies the concept. And there's a triad there. Can you say it again? Dimly?
Oh, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face.
And then
I know in part, but then I shall know fully, just as I also have been fully known.
And we're talking about a different kind of knowing here. The dimness of the literal mind and the linear mind, it's very dim to reality. It's like seeing through a glass darkly. And then gradually, this something else begins to emerge. And this really interesting thing about, as I am known, it's as if a handshake has taken place. If we stand in this position, we are greeted. We are greeted, in a sense, by the divine, and there's an interplay. An interplay begins to take on a different form. And this, some have said, this is the action, maybe, of the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit, the third leg of the triad coming together. And I had mentioned before that Spinoza said that, like Moses, saw mind to mind, saw God, or face to face, physically, like in a physical way, whereas the Christ personage, it was mind to mind, or knowing, being known fully. It's a different kind of knowing. I remember once a long time ago, and it was in a particular chamber, very, very specific, and for whatever reason, EJ held out his hand and placed his palm to mine. And a great deal of information flowed between the two of us. But it was not there was no verbal information that flowed in that. Okay? Anything else, Molly? The Holy Guardian Angels. Now, Ivan, what was your question again?
Why do you think that this is characterized as the life of hopelessness? Yes, that is the wording, life of hopelessness.
Gosh, I don't know. I was hoping you had that answer.
I get to ask the question.
Aww.
It's Mark in Winnipeg.
Yes.
I think hope is a malevolent force. I think that this has been discussed in the tapes and issues of with respect to Talk of the Month. I say this because I think shuring or in the present is very, very different than being hopeful or wishful or longing. It's not emotional. And a life of hopelessness to me is a life of the Zen monk, austerity, courage, humbleness, being in the moment. And if you're in the moment, you don't need to be hopeful.
Right. Well put.
That could be the key to this, Mark, that to be the embodiment of the great guide. Maybe necessary.
Well, and I would think it might mean you suddenly come to the realization there is no escape from remaining centered in your essential self, and you have to put, because you're now no longer a child, you have to put away childish things. That is the interests and pursuits of the historical personality.
Yes. And if we come to a different place at that point. Hope always goes hand in hand with fear, hope and fear. It's a dichotomy. It's of the world, no question. But there's also this sense of dread. There is only one place to hang out now. The deeper you allow yourself to do this form of exercise and stand in that position of the fire of the inner guru, the longer you stay, you begin to realize there is no other life I can handle. There is nothing else that I will pursue. And yet, you're not quite there yet. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment with regard to Man on the Cross. If you are bound in this world, then in the higher world you are unbound. And to the extent in which you are bound by laws, higher laws in this world, it's the extent that your freedom exists in the higher dimensions.
You were going to say, Molly. Simon, can you read Piff's comment, please, for the tape?
Piff says, a life of first achieving the impossible and then being in the void with it forever, except in moments, while when known, even those moments are a mirror. That is hopeless.
Even those moments are a mirror?
While when known, even those moments are a mirror. Do you want me to read it again?
And go ahead and read Aria's.
Aria says, abandon hope, sounds bad, negative, but really, if you have a hope, you have attachment.
Attachment?
Well, that is, yeah, was going to be my question, too. I mean, what do we understand by hope? If there is an attachment there, if what are we hoping for, right?
And go ahead and read Piaggio's.
Piaggio, Mark hit the mark. The brain codes hoping quite differently from expecting, like the difference in trying and doing. Make that expecting in quotes.
When you stand in the position of this inner essential self, and you look forth both down the corridor where you've been and the corridor where you need yet to go, there is a sense of the other idea of the man on the cross is that you're bound to that task at that point. You're bound to that. We're bound to that work. There's no escape in a certain. There is no escape from it. That's it, period. And it's hopeless in regard to really the machine that you can go back to life in that manner. It ain't going to happen. You're tainted. You're diseased to go forward. Not necessarily a blessing.
I wonder also if it's if you were harboring a hope, the hope that you might be harboring on this path would be of your own salvation, the hope of your own
personal,
let's say, yeah, your own elevation, your own illumination, your own salvation, and so on. This guru exercise has nothing to do with your illumination or salvation or your escape, actually. There is no, you're saying there is no escape. It has to do with other people's blessings, dispensing with justice and dispensing with blessings.
With others. You're working
others.
On behalf of others instead of, you know, may these efforts be used for the benefit of all beings everywhere. The ego wants to say, may these efforts be used for the benefit of me, my ego. I want to be enlightened. I want to be smarter than everybody else. I want to have the power. I want to have the power over others. That's the ego play.
You know, if you think about it, I mean, it's a very, what you call that, like a oxymoron. It's a very unlikely combination, hopelessness and omniscience. I'm the guru.
Right.
I'm the guru, and this is my exercise of hopelessness. So, you know, there is an oddity about that. Something.
I translate, this is Mark in Winnipeg, I translate hopelessness as being completely impartial and completely detached from any and all results. At the same time, being able to make work efforts.
Yeah.
So it's almost, maybe that's a technical description. Hopelessness.
Life of hopelessness.
A life of hopelessness.
Huh. Nice.
It's the measure of the guru.
Nef.
Guru nef, yeah.
Yeah, there's a certain purity
guru
about
activity.
That, isn't there? There's a purity about standing in that position.
At the same time, it brings me, sorry, are you there, David?
Yeah, go ahead.
At the same time, in parallel to all these descriptions, the idea to jump into this posture of the guru and you be the one there gives me the idea that you don't hope anymore for that guru, for the hope that the guru is giving you the truth, is giving you the path. Now you have to be the path. It's not more than that carrot in front of you, which is the guru. Now you have to find the answers. You have to be the channel. There is no more anymore sending you the hope. You have to be the one.
No help without Christ.
Yeah, thus sacrificing the outer help of another.
Exactly.
You become very active. You have to be. You realize that you are the one that's on the path at this point. You realize that you are the one that's on the path. Truly realize that.
Really.
David?
Sure.
Yeah, well, one last thing. I know the time is running out. I've been doing a lot of research on listening to the tapes and talks. One thing that all of these sacrifices have in common is the idea that with each sacrifice, you are consciously creating a habit. And it's an 18-step process that I found him describing the book and sacrifices on the third side of the talk habits for about 2 minutes, but it's very obscure. And you can find that information there, but I haven't listened to the tape in 25 years. I can barely understand. But he's deliberately being vague and not precise with respect to these. Those are his words on the tape. So that's, I guess, why the work is for us to find this out for ourselves.
Yes. To find out this.
You're saying that these are created habits.
Yes.
Well, a habit is not conscious or unconscious. The habit, habits either lead to conscious life or unconscious life. And the whole process is to replace slowly one unconscious habits that lead to unconscious life with habits that lead to conscious life at each level.
Yes, and this then in the quatrain that we've worked with so many times, it ends with, "And my habits will carry me through."
And right, and that's all the essential self is a series of habits that survive death and survive what Uncle Claude called the Crusher. In this tape, it's interesting that he says that body of habits survives everything. It's the only thing that's indestructible after everything is destroyed through the process of disintegration.
And we have the ability now to work together to find guidance as to how to begin creating those inner habits that we can, I call them, we can eternalize them. But we have to consciously start to work to stand in that place now. We're lucky. We're lucky. We're still alive. And we have a chance to continue working on developing different conscious, active, full of attention habits that will survive this physical thing here.
And I think the aspect of a joyous aspect of that is comes from the fact that it's a joyous aspect of from a movement from unconscious to consciousness. And there's a joyous, as I'm reading these things, an expectation, an anticipation, which is different than being hopeful. It's
good.
Being in the moment, so, sensing more.
And in this particular, the joy of this sacrifice is that as we mourn, in a sense, the giving up of the total outward direction, but we find joy in finding the inner position and inner posture of that essential self that we can now live from. So that's pretty much it for tonight. And so thank you once again for coming. We'll take it up again next week on Wednesday at 7 o'clock, and Ivan, what's our chapter at that point?
Well, in sacrifice 12, sacrifice of existence. Ordinary life, it says here.
Well,
more hopelessness.
We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Dave and Ivan.
Good night.
Night.
Thank you. Thank you.